Okay, reading part two, text 22. Kritartham bhakti nashtam bhakti nashtam saranya dharanatha. Although the scene ceases to exist for one whose purposes is accomplished, to liberate his soul, it does not cease to exist altogether, since it is common to other persons, parentheses, non-liberated soul. Om jnana samarandasya jnanandana salakaya taktu vinvatam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha. Chaitanya mano vishtam napitam yena bhutale sayam rupa kadamayam tadasi sa padantikam. Pancha kalpa taru gishta vipashindhu vaye vija patitanam pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo namo namah. Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Sivasadi Gaur Bhaktavinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Okay. Although the scene ceases to exist for one whose purpose is accomplished, it does not cease to exist altogether, since it is common to other Purushas. Commentary, I just read a little bit about it. This sutra situates the yoga tradition as realists. The view that the world is objectively and externally real, irrespective of whether we perceive it, as opposed to idealists. The world is not objectively or externally real, but a product of the mind. Das Gupta uses the term reals for the gunas. From Panjali and the commentarial tradition will take some point to refute the idealistic viewpoint. Chapter 4. The scene may have accomplished its purpose, vitarka, for the fortunate successful yogis attain liberation, and thus may cease to exist, nashtana, nashtam, for such a soul, but only in the sense that the liberated soul ceases to be aware of it. It is not accomplished purpose for other Purushas, says Vyasa. It needs to provide objects of experience for everyone else. Therefore, it still has a purpose and does not cease to exist, anashtam. Color may not be seen by a blind man, says Vachaspati Mishra, but does not cease to be, since it is seen by those who are not blind. In this sense, the conjunction between the seers, in the sense of the totality of the Purushas, and the scene is said to be eternal because the Purushas are innumerable. So one need not posit the hypothetical possibility that eventually all Purushas become liberated, causing Prakriti to become redundant due to an absence of Purushas meaning experience. So let's just put this in context, because it's philosophical subject matter, and we come back to it each week and just put it in context. Not everybody is on every week. So this second chapter is about Kriya Yoga, the yoga of action, which is meant to bring oneself to the point of yoga, which means the process of meditative absorption, which is takes a very, very high degree of concentration and purity of heart. And this threefold process of Kriya Yoga of tapasya, simplicity, swadhyaya, studying the chanting of mantras, and Ishvara Pranidhan, dedicating your life to God. Patanjali is going to discuss in this section. And what he discusses first is that this will bring you to the ultimate goal of samadhi. It will purify your heart to the degree that you can actually meditate without distraction. In our own tradition of Gaudiya Vaishnavism and how Prabhupada presented it through the Bhagavad Gita, very much it's discouraged to prematurely go to, let's say, Radhakund, the most holy place, and sit down and meditate. Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Nitya Chara Sahuchate, such a person is a cheater. If he won't be able to meditate, when he closes his eyes, for all day, which is what meditative absorption is, after some time, he'll just be meditating on the mental imprints that are desires that are coming to his consciousness in terms of family, in terms of enmity, in terms of sex desire, etc. So this process it describes, if you could follow these principles, it will bring you to the point, it'll give that perfectional goal in a progressive way, and it will destroy the kleshas, the most fundamental psychological conceptions that are at the foundation of material existence. And the cause of karma, and therefore the cause of suffering. Because any fruitive, selfish desire, or any material result, leads to an increased attachment to the body, and ultimately, therefore, a deeper experience of suffering. That's the paradox in the material world, that pleasure leads to suffering, because it intensifies the identification with the body. Where real suffering takes place, it doesn't take place in our true nature. The material afflictions and even the mental afflictions are happening, according to yoga, within the buddhi. And because the soul is identifying with that, it's suffering. So anything that increases that identification is increasing one's suffering. Because, as said, it was very nice that the experience of suffering is 100 times more than the experience of pleasure. So whatever little pleasure you get, when that suffering comes, which is greater, you'll suffer more. And therefore, two simple principles, that in Bhagavad Gita, the same thing is, the conjunction is due to this desire to selfishly enjoy. And that desire creates the identification of the soul or purusha with the body. So at this particular section that we've been discussing now, it's really going to be this analysis of suffering from all different angles. Because, after all, what does Kriya Yoga do? destroys the patients, the roots of suffering. And just think of how much of our consciousness and our desires is to free ourselves from suffering. Basically, as we all know, on that platform of identification with the mind and the body, although there is temporary pleasure, mostly it's suffering. On that platform, mostly it's suffering, because even if you have tremendous karma for material enjoyment, you still have to die. And therefore, even the person with the most charmed life without spiritual knowledge is in a constant state of fear. It's the sand in the sweet rice. It may be so luscious and so well cooked, but if there's a little sand in it, you can't enjoy it. And therefore, there is that sand, because we know that people don't live like that. Karma is somehow, you know, one who is happy will be unhappy. One who is unhappy will be happy. So we know it's not exactly like, but we know that it's not all. But even if it is, it's true. Because there's that type of duality here in the world. So there's a discussion of suffering. Why? Understand the root cause. So when you understand the cause, then you understand the solution. Just like they don't know the cause of cancer, they can't stop it. When you find the cause of something, then you alleviate the suffering by eradicating the cause of that suffering. So this is so important. What is the root cause of suffering? We're all suffering. And if we're not, we're an illusion. We're all suffering. Because even if it's charmed, and how many of us right now have charmed lives? But how many people you know have charmed lives? Who's not dealing with some sickness? Some relational problem, unfulfillment of a particular desire. Who's not experiencing that? So it's such an important thing. What is the cause? And that's why one practices yoga. One practices yoga because one wants to become happy. That's why one practices yoga. Really happy, not the duality of happiness and stress, but the existential condition of happiness when one transcends the conjunction of the soul and the body, which is the cause of suffering. And imbibes or dwells in the spiritual nature. In most schools of Indian thought or Indian philosophy, at least that commonality is there, that there is a transcendental platform, which is eternal, full of cognizance and happiness. So the conjunction, so it states, and this is the previous verse, I like to give summaries, and it's such a deep subject matter that I think it is beneficial for me, and I hope everyone else, that we go over these things again and again. The conjunction of the seer and the seen is the cause of suffering. So now we know the cause. And then the chapter will also tell you then, therefore, how to eradicate the cause. And the seen is all objects that present oneself to the intelligence, the buddhi, and make impressions in the buddhi, and That's what it means, that the soul, its perception is through the intelligence, where the impressions of all experience lies. And the soul is observing that. And mistaking that to be the nature of the self. But it's that conjunction. And then, he, as a good scholar, he mentions the seeing and the seer, drashta, or drashta, who is the seeing, or what is seeing, the soul of the body. But they, what is the seeing? And comes to the point that the ultimate metaphysical ingredient, the ultimate ingredient, is the gunas, or the modes of nature. And everything is composed of that. And basically, it's different forms, not just visual forms, sound, or it's different forms of the sense objects that give a different experience to the soul that wants to enjoy it. It gives them the experience of illumination and peace. It gives them the experience of activity and anxiety. It gives them the experience of inertia and ignorance, which are basically the core foundational experiences of enjoyment. And of course, suffering also. Suffering. Intense activity, sensual stimulation is pleasure, but it's also suffering. And inertia is also pleasure. Sometimes we just love to sleep. We love to do nothing. We love to sit around. For some person that has that, some star in nature. That's the thing. Ultimately, it's the gunas. And then it describes what is the seer. The seer is pure. It's the power of observation. It's the soul. And it's pure, but it witnesses the images of the mind. And if the identification is there, it has a certain experience of the images of the mind as the self. And three examples were given of this. One was probably given by Professor Bryant. He gave the example of like software. There's so much information there in the software. But it's not thinking. It's not thinking. There has to be an observer. Although it looks like it's computing things, so many things are happening. It's been programmed, but it's not thinking. It's on a screen. Or the other example is the moon reflected in water. Not the moon, the reflection. And when it moves, it appears that the moon is moving. And a child may think that the moon is moving, and a child may be fearful that the moon is moving. But the moon is not actually moving. So again, same thing. Consciousness or soul is projected on the body and the mind. Mind is changing, and depending on your maturity. Depending on your maturity and understanding, you'll be affected by it or not. The adult will not be affected by it, the child will. So similarly, in the same way, as the our self appears to be moving and changing and experiencing so many things, the degree that you will be affected by it is the degree of your maturity and spiritual discrimination. And then the last example was like an echo. Sound kind of bounces back. So the consciousness soul bounces back to the soul and therefore experiences. Finally, the essential nature of this, that which is seen, there is the body and the mind, it's exclusively for the sake of the soul. The whole material world exists exclusively for the sake of the soul. Example, like the bed. The bed exists for the sake of the person who rests on the bed. The king and his possession. The possessions of the king exist solely for the king. So the body and the mind, it exists solely to give the soul experience of enjoyment and to facilitate liberation. That's the purpose of it has no purpose within itself. And therefore, when you no longer need it, because you are not interested in the experiences of the world, and when you no longer need it, because you are liberated from those desires that necessitate conjunction with the body, then you're no longer aware of it. It ceases to exist for you. And now an essential question will come up in the next verse, and it's very, very important. And the question is, and that's the verse we're discussing today, since it has purpose, does it cease to exist when one becomes liberated? And in the school, which is commonly accepted in the West as being the philosophy of India, which is the weight of the Vedanta. It's amazing. I read this one book called Reasons for God by a minister, a Christian minister in New York, who's a brilliant, very brilliant speaker. Very successful person of turning urban professionals to evangelical Christianity. So he wrote a book, Reasons for God. He's a cutting-edge preacher. And I bought the book to see what his arguments are. But in the many good arguments he has, he presents the superiority of Christianity to other religions. And when I'm reading it, I'm thinking, the guy's such a scholar, but the criticisms he has of Hinduism do not apply to Gaudiya Vaishnavism, my tradition, Vaishnavism, or most Indian schools of thought, because of the six Indian schools of thought, only Advaita Vedanta, one school of the school of Vedanta, has this conception that God does not have energy. And therefore, this amorphous unity, that there's actually just one being, there's not individual souls, and that matter is just an absolute illusion. That's only one school that has that view. Where every other school believes in the eternality of the soul, that we are an individual soul, and that when we become liberated, we remain an individual soul, although comprised of the same spiritual substance as the totality of being, which is God. The same quality, the same nature, but individual, existing as an emanation or energy of God. Om Purnam Adap Purnam Nidam Purnam Purnam. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Absolute Reality is perfect and complete. And although so many units emanate from him, he remains the complete balance. This is because this is the basis of the faith of the God, that God cannot have energies emanating from him, and God becomes less. Therefore, that distinction, Jadmadya Syayataha, that it is from him whom everything else comes, there are actually energies emanating from that divine spiritual principle. It must be illusion, because it fragments the absolute or something like that. But of course, in most schools of thought, they accept that the absolute reality has inconceivable potency. And therefore, so much energy can emanate without its the absolute reality becoming nullified. And point is even in ordinary person, even the way his nails grow is inconceivable. So his inconceivable potency of God, that's a reasonable conception of the absolute reality, that he has inconceivable potency, that he's not subject to the laws of logic based on the foundation of material cause and effect. Above that. So, so here, at first it says that yoga is realist, meaning the world is objective, whether or not we perceive it or not. I think in Buddhism, or I'm not sure which schools of thought, and in chapter 4, Patanjali is going to take pains to refute it, that they have, the concept is that experience is based on the experiencer somehow or other, that what's seen is based on the, it can't exist without an observer. But here, it says yoga has a realist view. So the body as the self may cease to exist for one soul who no longer, as said in the last verse, or with previous verses, I mean, it was the last verse, yes. It has no use for a particular soul that becomes liberated, but it doesn't mean that matter is based on the mind and therefore ultimately illusory. No, it's a separate, independent energy of God which exists eternally. And therefore, this sutra is important to the yoga school because opponents might question, this is the purport to be dependent, what? That matter is eternal, Prakriti is eternal. That's yoga. That's most schools of thought. The creation is ongoing. So these are Though most schools posit an eternal polarity of the drushes, whether liberated or non-liberated. And then there's just some arguments for this. I find one particularly good. The others I'm not. First, he gives the example. There's a common one by the Eternal Third. It's the a commentary on Swetashvatara Upanishad. He gives the example that there's a... it's just that that one is the example that there may be a nanny goat, which is matter, and it's enjoyed by the billy goat, which is the Purusha. But then that billy goat, some reason or other, no longer has need for that nanny goat. But then there's another one that wants to enjoy. So because one has no need for it, it doesn't mean that it ceases to exist. So we may become liberated, have no need for matter, and the body as the self, because that's just an illusion. The body exists. But it's not the self. The conception that this is a person, the body, that's an illusion that we live in and suffer for. Just think how many times we suffer because of that egoistic conception and identity of this particular field of matter is the self and how much suffering it causes to us. So, so it's not the self. And then there's many references in the Upanishads that seem to apply that there's the oneness of all atmas. This is a classic one. In other words, it gives the Purvapaksha, the opposing view. And this is quoted by Vigyan Bhakshu of Bhiksha. The Markandeya Purana says, just as the ether, although one, may exist as divided into many in pots, jars, and water containers, so I, the mighty armed king of Kasi, and others are divided into different bodies with physical distinctions, but there's one pot. So just as, this is an example, just as there's the sky, which may be divided into pots, it's just an illusion that there's separate sky, there's one sky. Just this kind of illusion that it's separate. And there's other verses like that. But the commentators explain that the unity is describing that it's the same essence. Not that there's no individuality, that there's the same essence, that we're particle of consciousness of the supreme consciousness. We're part of God. But it doesn't mean because we have the same essence that essence cannot that essence, which is the same nature of divine being, is the divine being. And has no separate eternality or individuality of its own. And here's what I think is the slam dunk argument against this debate of the fact. And this is given by Vigyan Bhikshu, who happens to be a Vedantist. And he's written extensive commentaries on the Vedanta Sutra, in which he's critically discussed the one Atman theory of the Dvaita non-dual school of Vedanta. So here's the slam dunk argument, I think. He says, if there were only one Atman, or soul, continues Vigyana Bhikshu, how could some Atmans be liberated and others still in samsara? A number of the commentators draw attention to this argument, which also surfaces in the Vedanta school's opposing the Vedanta viewpoint. If there were ultimately only one soul, or Atma, as the Advaita school posits, then when any one Purusha or soul attains liberation, so would all the other Purushas, since according to the Advaita school, they are in reality one Purusha or Atma. In other words, if one Purusha or soul became liberated by realizing that all distinctions among Purushas were illusory, and that all Purushas were in actuality one undivided Atma, then, with the ignorance of duality removed, there would no longer be any more divided souls or independent Purushas or souls. If one responds that the realization of the oneness of Atman applies only to the liberated souls, not to the other non-liberated souls, then one has implicitly accepted a duality in the supposed oneness of the Atman, a duality between liberated and non-liberated souls. Such a conclusion would be awkward for the defenders of this position, say the commentators, contradicting the non-dualistic position of the Advaita school, but approaching the position of the Yoga school. So in other words, I think it's a brilliant argument. If you say there's actually only one soul, and one soul becomes liberated, and how can others soul, then who's in Maya? And if you say, well, that's non-liberated soul, then you have a dualism. Then you have a distinction that there's one soul that's liberated and another that's not, which is against the theory. And that's more that kind of view that there is liberated and non-liberated souls is more the view of the Yoga school and Sankhya and Vaisheshika and Mamamsa and Dhyaya and theistic Vedanta. So Vigyan Bhikshu continues to argue that not only are individual Purushas different from each other, but the Supreme Purusha God is different again from the individual souls. He points to the Vedanta Sutra. Brahman is greater than embodied beings because of the statement of difference between them. And the embodied souls are parts of God because of the statement that they are different. But Kachali has, anyway, already established that Ishvara is a distinct Purusha and superior to other Purushas. Are there any questions so far? If there are no questions, I will read one more verse for today. The notion of conjunction is the means of understanding the real nature of the powers of the possessed and the possessor. So this verse is explaining the nature of the conjunction between the soul and the body. That the body is the possessed and the soul is the possessor. So I'm going to read the purport a little bit. Tying the verses in this chapter together is touched upon in 11 and 2:15, and echoing the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism, the theme of this second pod chapter is suffering. The cause of suffering, the state beyond suffering, and the means to attain this state. Specifically, verses 1 through 14 were dedicated to the immediate causes of suffering on a psychological level, cause of suffering with the kleshas and their consequences. And 15, to the reality of suffering itself, that all is suffering. The 16, the future suffering can be avoided. Because you can't avoid the suffering in the past, you're already suffering now. but you can avoid the suffering in the future by finding out what caused your suffering now and not doing that, actually. And then 17, the cause of suffering on a metaphysical level is the union, samyog, between the seer, drashti, and the seer, drashya. And 18 and 19, the cause in terms of the seeing. Then 20, to the seer in the state beyond suffering. Anyway, this sutra through 27 will deal with samyog, union, the metaphysical cause of suffering. And samyog, this union's removal, the remainder of the chapter will be devoted to the means to accomplish it. With, what is it, three things we're mentioning? The cause of suffering, the state beyond suffering, and the means to attain this. Worldly experience means perceiving the scene. Worldly experience means is perceiving the scene. Liberation means perceiving the nature of the scene. So what we're observing right now, it keeps us in bondage. When our perception is to see ourselves, then we become liberated. So we try to see ourselves as servants of God. We try to act on that platform. We try to consciously act on the platform of the soul so that we change our identification by changing the desire of what we want to be. If you want to be the enjoyer, then you stay focused on the perception of the mind and body. And if you want to be the servant or the soul, then you focus on the nature of the self and see everything in relation to that service. I've often described this as object consciousness rather than subject consciousness. You don't see yourself as the subject, you see yourself as the object. Material consciousness, you see yourself as the subject and you see everything else as an object for your enjoyment. Spiritual consciousness means you see yourself as the object. Therefore, you're no longer you're no longer the controller. Anyway, that's cool. The cause of this conjunction is ignorance, and it's going to be discussed in more detail in future classes. That's about what I've covered today. Would anybody like to say hello, Hare Krishna?
Jai Maharaj, it's Hare Krishna.
Okay, let's see. We're going to get into probably some more popular and interesting stuff soon, which is the yams and the niyams and the mystic powers. So maybe we'll put that out.
Okay.
Others may want to join us there. And I'll send you Nick's address. You know, he's not going to January 5th, but I'll send that. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, anybody else like to say hello?
Irish Maharaj.
Who's that?
Govardhan.
Okay, Govardhan. Hare Krishna. Thank you for being on. Great. Good. Any other friendly voices like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, this is Gail.
Gail, I knew you were out there, even if you have no questions. Okay, thank you, Gail.
Okay.
Okay. Looks like we have basically a core of the regulars, and then there's a bunch of regulars that don't announce themselves. That's not obligatory. Okay, anybody else? Otherwise, we're going to go for today.
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Okay, Amya, just give me your phone number. I'd rather I'll call you back privately. What's your phone number? Okay, I'll call you right back. Okay, Hare Krishna.
Thank you, Maharaj. Hare Krishna.
Bye, Bill.